From Mountain Crest to Mountain Crest, from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we are pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. I'm your host, Vance Pollock, and this is Joshua P. Warren speaking of strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and most intriguing guests. We are the favorite program of hodags, wendigos, skunk apes, and donkey devils. Which one are you? So keep it tuned right here. This hour, a little bit of hodgepodge, guys. We're just gonna hit the high spots. We got some fun stuff, a little bit of morbid news, because I like morbid. How about this one? Drop dead beautiful. Japan undertakers tested on how to dress a corpse. Doesn't sound all that unusual. What you think about it, there are undertaking establishments around the world that deal with this sort of thing. It's just another job to do. Was that a Don Henley song? It's just a job you do, or was that Genesis, Phil Collins?
Either one, I've blocked it permanently.
Yeah, may have been Genesis, Phil Collins. Anyway, just a job you do. A 23-year-old undertaker won a contest at Japan's biggest funeral expo on Thursday that tested ancient skills in the ritual dressing of the dead. I practiced every day to prepare for this competition, said a smiling Reno Terai after her win over three other finalists. I took video and made improvements by asking myself, does this look beautiful? Am I treating the deceased kindly? Japan's Shinto religion believes that the soul is impure shortly after death, and the process of dressing a body, usually in front of close relatives only, purifies the deceased spirit before it is sent off to the other world. Japan's aging society has increased demand for undertakers with special skills, said the head of that academy. There are about 2,000 undertakers whose expertise is in dressing the deceased, but their skills vary a lot, he said. I wanted this competition to be a way to spur undertakers to improve their skills. The four contestants dressed live human volunteers laying on mattresses arranged on a stage. They were observed by three judges as funeral music gently played in the background. The four were judged on the grace of their movements and their ability to dress the body without revealing too much bare skin. The movement of their hands were really beautiful, Akane Matsuda said after watching the competition. Yeah, a funeral dressing competition, guys. A little bit creepy.
Yeah. Did you ever see that Jack Black movie, Bernie?
Yes.
It's probably my favorite Jack Black movie.
It's fairly amusing.
And it's based on a true story.
Jack Black is an undertaker,
a mortician, and yeah, at the beginning of the movie, there he's doing a class on how to teach how to dress a corpse.
Yeah, providing the tip to use a little super glue under mm-hmm. the eyelids to keep them closed. Mm-hmm. Yeah, useful little things like that. Well, at least you know it was a competition within the industry. It's like going to a trade show. I mean, I'm sure there must be like funeral trade shows. Yeah, you get like the trade publications and everything like that.
I subscribe. Yeah.
There are probably some morbid people not in the industry that do subscribe to the trade pubs of
He's using the slang vernacular. The trade pubs.
The trade pubs. I subscribe to the, funerals today. Yeah, embalming today. Cremation this week.
weekly cremation with Vance Pollock.
Yeah. Wow. Maybe we should talk to somebody about it. I think most of those guys have, while they seem very stoic, you know, their presentation when they're on, you know, at the funerals and everything, they're very stoic, very solemn. They
very
need to be.
Dark sense of humor.
But, yeah, you chat with some of these guys, and they do have, a dark sense of humor. I guess you would have to live with that, to live day in, day out with death.
I think it's great. I mean, it's a part of life that we don't think about, that it's the one thing that we all share in common.
I knew a guy that played in a ska band out of Blacksburg, Virginia. Well, I mean, here's the story about Sluggo. He worked in a crematorium, and you may not realize after cremation, there's still some bone fragments and things like that that have to be ground down. Maybe we talked about this on our discussion of the cremains on the Blue Ridge Parkway that I desecrated. But that's another story. But anyway, Sluggo said, you know, you have to grind down these bone fragments and everything like that. And if people had implants, you know, like titanium, you know, fake hips or whatever, you couldn't grind that stuff down. You just had to do away with it.
So
he had an artificial hip door knocker that had been through the furnace, you know, so it was blackened and everything, but here was this this creepy door knocker that was actually in somebody's hip for an indefinite period.
I actually have somebody's hip as my door knocker.
Like a
human
like
bone.
The human bone. We used to decorate with cow skulls and bones and stuff like that as a kid growing up in the rural parts of Florida. I guess that's not too unusual. Cow skulls used to be pretty decorative. Whatnots made out of.
I would go find railroad like spikes, but never cow skulls.
Railroad spikes were cool. Yeah. Who didn't collect railroad spikes as a kid?
I don't know.
Growing up, good old days. All we needed was a cow skull and a railroad spike, and
it was a simpler time.
Oh my goodness! I've got some things that can obviously be saved for the Dark 30, but just to kind of keep the foolishness going here, to lighten things up a little bit, because that probably hurt some feelings. The story about the funeral expo. I don't know. Patients treated for putting sunscreen in eyes during the eclipse.
Dummies.
What?
This September 13th, that's a caption from a photo from way back. But anyway, this is from WCMH. Those looking for alternative ways to protect their eyes from last week's solar eclipse are now seeking medical treatment after putting sunblock on their eyeballs. Nurse practitioner told KRCR she hasn't seen any cases of damage by looking directly at the sun, but she and her colleagues have sent a few patients who experienced pain after putting sunblock in their eyes. One of my colleagues at Moonlight here stated yesterday that they had patients presenting at their clinic that put sunscreen on their eyeball and that they were having pain, and they were referred to an ophthalmologist. According to the National Capital Poison Center, sunscreen getting in your eyes can cause pain and irritation. They recommend rinsing with running water as the best first aid. They don't have quotes from any of these supposed presenters, but yeah, just put some sunblock on your eyes and you can stare at the sun
What was your eclipse like?
My eclipse experience was nice. I kind of wish, after seeing some other pictures of totality and of the crescent shadows, that I had been paying more attention to the shadows, which nobody warned me that the shadows were going
like
to get freaky.
Many eclipses.
Yeah. The leaves on the trees acted as millions of little pinhole cameras in the sidewalks and walls. Anyway, anywhere the shadows fell at a certain point would look like little crescents. And I wasn't looking for that, so I didn't see the crescent pinhole camera effect.
It was a little overcast, a little cloudy, unfortunately, like right at the time of the exact Passover here, or in South Asheville anyway. I had some pretty ballin' glasses. Thanks, Mom. She had ordered plenty of time in advance. But I liked the how it got cool. That was kind of neat, how the temperature dropped, and it got dark enough that all the street lights came on.
Right. Chickens were crowing. I was out in Leicester. I was up the road here in Leicester, and the chickens started crowing, obviously
birds,
confused.
Yeah, birds were doing some weird stuff.
Yeah, crickets and insects started chirping. Yeah, it was interesting, and I got to observe it so that I understood what was happening. Of course, you don't see necessarily the motion in a time lapse. You can, but I was watching it steadily enough, right at peak here in the area, so I saw what was going on. You got the crescent on one side, you got the shadow completely covering the sun with just a little slice at the top, and then the crescent appearing out the other side. So I actually, you know, observed the shadow moving across as much as it would.
I would have liked to see that flare better from like where like it was completely covered up and you could take the glasses off and see the actual flare around.
Man, so many amazing videos and photographs and reports from people who went down to Greenville to see it. And yeah, totality was the way to go. I didn't know it would be that much a difference, but just
it was like a point, like we had like 98.8% totality or something, or 99, it was close, but it was enough to make it not total.
Right, it seemed rather twilight.
Yes,
I'll say, but it didn't get as dark as
I did.
As
it was the first time I ever like wandered around my apartment complex, saying, "Where's the sun?" Like I walked out and I was looking for the sun. But I couldn't see because it was blocked by a building, so I had to like start wandering around to try to get to a higher spot to actually see where it was in the sky over the buildings.
Okay.
And so I found some people hanging out. I just joined them, and it was a very odd assortment of people who did not know one another.
Right.
Like one lady had like she had already had the T-shirt on. It was like the Path of Totality 2017, and she's like, you know, this isn't going to happen again until she like just spouting off all the facts. She had the hat on and everything. And she was totally into the eclipse, totally into it.
Very nice. Shelley, how was your eclipse?
It was good. I stayed here in Asheville.
Mm-hmm.
The coin shop stayed open and Nevermore stayed open. And Greg was the only one of us that had eclipse glasses, but he didn't trust that they were going to work. So Michael and I were passing them between us right there at the end. And it was really cool. We had a good view. We were standing outside in the parking lot there, and it was really fun. We had a great time.
My wife and kids, a woman after my own heart, they watched the eclipse from above Gash Creek Cemetery.
Really?
Yeah, which you know where that is, right off I-40. Nice
view. I'm going to say off of Gaseous Creek.
Yeah. pretty darn correct right there, Sam. Anyway, that's our eclipse wrap-up here on Speaking of Strange, and we'll be right back after these messages. This is Speaking of Strange on WWNC 570 AM here in the mountains and around the globe at speakingofstrange.com. You can catch up with us on the Speaking of Strange Facebook page, which is simply enough, facebook.com/speakingofstrange. I'm Vance Pollock. Did I say that? No, I did. And we're just kind of breezing through. We were doing our eclipse post game last segment. I hope everybody out there, listeners, got a chance to check out the eclipse. I had a lot of friends, like I say, that drove a little ways out, what would usually be 45 minutes or an hour out, and it took them a little longer because there was a lot of traffic. People said they got hung up in a lot of traffic, but worth it by all accounts. And if you've got any strange eclipse stories, we'd like to hear them. You can hit me up with via email, in an email. I don't know why I stumbled over that. But the email address is there on the website, speakingofstrange.com, right down there below my mugshot and bio. And, help yourself to my personal email address. If you've got important things to share, we'd love to hear from you. I'm not afraid. Sam, we were just talking about collecting records. You've mentioned picking up a Roald Dahl reading of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, which is very cool, on vinyl. Minty is the way you described it. Have you seen or heard of making albums with your ashes in it? We're going to do another cremains story. Have you ever seen that you can have your ashes, your mortal remains, stamped into a
doesn't
record
seem like
album?
It would be a great medium for playback.
Well, no, I think it's basically some of the ashes.
Yeah, I mean, it'll make a swirl
inside
the marbled vinyl.
Yeah, I think maybe the ashes themselves would be a little gritty.
I mean, if you've got a bone in there, it could really make your needle skip.
Yeah. Here's a photo with a caption. Nice label of Madge Hobson on the Madge Hobson album. There is about a teaspoonful of Madge Hobson's ashes in her record. So there you go. It's just a teaspoon or so of your ashes in the mix that they made the album with. But here's more details on this phenomenon. This is a article just reported on BBC.com. Even though I'd heard of this phenomenon, if you would call it that, this trend or this thing before. This is a pretty nice, in-depth, sort of a personal human interest article. John Hobson is listening to a recording of conversations with his late mother, mostly small talk about family. The words are on a vinyl record, although this is more than a recording of memories. The ashes of Madge Hobson are combined with the vinyl, with a photograph and details of her life printed on the labels. It makes a perfect family record, which can be passed down for generations, says Jason Leach, founder of And Vinyly, which produced the disc. The firm is part of a fast-growing sector of the end-of-life industry. That's right, the end-of-life industry. That's the trade pubs that we need to subscribe to, end-of-life industry. You no longer need ashes be stored in an urn or scattered to the wind. Now you can wear, drink from, or display a little part of what is left of your loved one. Mr. Hobson, a 69-year-old sculptor, says his mother, a devout churchgoer, would thoroughly approve of her record. I had to weigh out a quantity of the ashes, which had been kept in an urn, and put a large teaspoonful into a number of small plastic bags, one for each disc, he says. 15 records were pressed for family and friends, says Mr. Hobson. I think And Vinyly has undoubtedly helped to keep the memory of my mother alive. Mr. Leach, based in Scarborough, North Yorkshire, began pondering the possibilities of pressing ashes into records about 10 years ago. There was no business plan. He was just reflecting on mortality, issues brought into sharper focus when his mother began work at a funeral director's. I was amazed by how little I or any of my friends had even properly considered or even accepted our own mortality, and how incredibly sheltered many of us are from death and conversations around it, Mr. Leach says. It was not intended to be a business. It was the result of having a bit of fun with what at the time felt like a shocking and disconcerting inevitability. The process is the same as making a standard vinyl disc with ashes, human or pet, added at a specific stage in production. It's a balance between adding enough ashes so as to be seen, but not so much as to affect the groove's smooth playing, says Mr. Leach. There will, of course, be some extra pops and crackles resulting from the inclusion of ashes, but we like these, as this is you. Prices vary as every request is different, he says. A basic package costs about £900, rising to about £3,000. And the pound is, what, about a buck 30 or something like that? So add another 30% on that. We're talking like $1,200 for the basic package and maybe up around $4,000 for the deluxe package. Options include 7-inch or 12-inch discs, specially composed music, a portrait painted on the record using the ashes, and clear or colored vinyl. Mr. Leach, a music producer and music label owner, currently presses about 2 discs a month that have human ashes added to them on equipment he already owns, but he is in the process of arranging more funding to meet rising demand. He is also linking with funeral homes, which will offer the service. The concept markets itself, he says. Of course, there are those who find it strange, even creepy, but most people actually come around to the idea. I like it. What do you think, Shelley?
I think it's kind of creepy.
Friends or loved ones that pass on before you, you wouldn't want their record with some of their mortal remains in it?
No.
I would, so I could play it backwards.
Oh, goodness. One of the guys from, oh, man, I was thinking of it as I was reading over the article, but it totally slipped my mind because he died here locally. I think he died over in Madison County. Gosh, really avant-garde, sort of difficult listening group. I'll come up with the name eventually, but...
Captain Beefheart.
No, more modern than that, more punk. I would say more along the lines of Dead Kennedys, gonzo punk sort of thing. They had a... I totally blew that one. But anyway, here's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I'll get you the facts if we come back around to it at some point. Guy over in Madison County was in this hardcore, you know, sort of a cult punk noise band. And when he died a few years ago and the band put out a memorial 7-inch record, each copy of like this 500 limited edition record had a little Ziploc baggie with some of his ashes in it. So that's pretty cool. If you're a fan of the band, you get to buy a limited edition record. And
remember the Kiss Blood comic?
No, I don't.
You don't know the Kiss Blood
the
comic?
The Kiss Blood comic, no.
That's where they did a comic book back in like 77, 78. They had their own blood taken. And the comic book was like done, like a part of it, in their blood. We'll find them.
Oh,
I can't believe you don't know about it.
The Kiss Blood comic. No, I mean, it's doesn't surprise me, but yeah, Kiss. There was something about Gene Simmons trying to copyright the goat horns. I call it throwing the goat, but it's, you know, the index and the pinky finger up, and it's not the I love you. If you kick your thumb out to the side and it's your pinky and your index and your thumb sticking out, that's IL. That's an abbreviation for I love you. Don't throw
go.
That at a metal show.
77 Marvel Comics published Super Special Kiss in full color comic book, presenting the band as superheroes. Blood from each band member was drawn by a registered nurse, witnessed by a notary public, and poured into vats of red ink used for printing the comic at Marvel's Borden Ink plant in Nephew, New York. So they actually had Kiss Blood in it.
Jeez.
Yeah.
The Kiss Blood comic. Never knew it, man. Never knew it. That sounds like an urban legend, but...
It's not. Let's see what they're going for on eBay right now.
Yeah.
You're looking for that, you know, about 500, depending on... Depending
Sheesh.
On, you know, 250.
I wonder if there's actually enough of their blood in that that you could, you
clone?
Know, DNA test it. You could clone members of KISS from
that. I don't
that
think
comic
we need
book.
Another Gene Simmons. You know, he also said, you know, he about the devil horn thing. He also owns the copyright to the money bags that you might see in a cartoon, like guys running away with bags of money from a bank. He owns that.
What?
We'll be right back on Speaking of Strange. Yeah. Thanks, Dave. The late David Bowie.
The
everyone.
Thin White Duke.
Negative Land. You remember those guys, Sam? Did you ever check them out?
Negative Land.
The band Negative Land.
Does not ring a bell.
New Negative Land album comes with a bag of band members' remains. This was just last October. So, I mean, it's not ancient history, and I'm not sure if this band member's the one that lived over in Madison County or not, but yeah, one of the guys from Negative Land had bought a farm out, well, you bought the farm
out in, more ways than one
in Marshall, but I'm not familiar enough with the guys in the band to tell you which one was our neighbor over here, but yeah, he, I think he has passed away as well, and one of these references was to the band being from San Francisco, so maybe it was one of the dudes on the West Coast who actually lent his cremains to.
Can you give me any credence to this story? I was talking about on the rock station that I do stuff on the other night. I was playing a Meat Puppets song, and I wanted to say that the brothers Kirkwood, Chris and Kirk Kirkwood, there was an Asheville connection. I had heard from back in the day that their grandparents lived in Swannanoa or Black Mountain, and they would spend the summers here with their grandparents until their teenage years.
Brothers from the Meat Puppets, you say?
Chris and Kirk Kirkwood, yes.
I don't know, man.
Do you know about a Gibby Haynes Butthole Surfers connection to Asheville?
I do not know about a Gibby Haynes Butthole Surfers connection.
I think he used to be like part owner of a guitar store up near Broadway.
No joke.
Yeah.
But that's significant. Significant
but
enough.
But those were two things that I was doing a story on last week, and I couldn't find concrete evidence on either of them.
You were telling me a story about some punkers that hung out in Asheville back in the day, right? Maybe it was in more recent times, maybe in the 90s, and you played me a song that was Asheville.
Who? Give me more.
Yeah, an Asheville punk rock song.
Oh, that was Pinhead Gunpowder or Cleveland Bound Death Sentence, and the song was called Asheville.
Right. Yes. But those guys were connected to some other bigger names that
Aaron also... Comet Bus was the drummer for both, and he lived in the Pink House, the infamous punk squat down there on Broadway past the bridge.
Okay.
That's now been demolished or burned down. It's across from that coffee shop going down Broadway towards UNCA.
Right.
And Billy Joe Armstrong from Green Day had lived there for a period of time in the early 90s.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty significant to a lot of people.
That whole building was very significant. A lot of music that probably nobody's ever heard of. But, I mean, the fact that Aaron Comet Bus, who not only was a drummer in many, many bands, but he's one of the more famous zine writers. His zine was called Comet Bus, and he still makes it to this day, if I'm correct. They would sell it at Downtown Books and News and always go down there and hope that they had a new issue or something. And he worked at a Xerox copy shop, and so he would do like these, you know, Xeroxes of Xeroxes and, you know, make these zines, and he would hand write, like each one was like all handwritten. And they were just like punk rock stories, like little novellas. Again, they were great. And some of those early issues now go for a lot of money.
Very cool. And that was coming out of Asheville back in the day, huh?
Well, he had spent some time here for a couple months in Asheville. But he was like a nomad. He would wander. He was from Berkeley, if I'm correct. Hence the Billy Joe connection as well. But yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on at that Pink House.
Asheville was an edgy place even back then, before it was Beer City. I remember in the 90s coming to Asheville trying to get a black and tan, and there were not even any restaurants that had Guinness and Harp on tap. You couldn't find it.
Well, not one that poured a Guinness properly, anyway.
Miller Lite and Budweiser Town. That was
a King Cobra
all
guy.
We had. We did have that, the Schlitz Malt Liquor Bull.
I had to quit drinking before, you know, we had to just have to go to Elizabethton, Tennessee to get, like, the good higher alcohol beers, you know. Like, I remember the one that stands out was Abita's Turbo Dog, which at the time was, like, a crushing 7.7 or something, which now I guess is laughable to the kids these days because they got stuff I see that's, like, you know, 15%+ alcohol beer. Which is crazy.
Well, what was our cheap domestic lager, and probably still is, like 2.3%?
No, or something. That's a misnomer. Budweiser was always 5.
Oh yeah,
except in Salt Lake City or instead in Utah.
Okay,
they brewed a different because of the Mormon.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, I know that when all the ice beers that got popular along
those
in
were
the
like,
mid 90s,
like
everything
five,
ice would bump it up just a little bit and
Bud
make
ice.
It taste
ice house
ham's ice. Ugh. Yeah, Schlitz ice.
I didn't know ham's had an ice.
Ham's had ice. Yes, it did, and it was not good. It tasted,
you know,
a
that
lot
hot
like
spot
bologna.
Down on Hilliard there, Hilliard and Ashland. They had this. I wish I would have saved a bottle or something. It was like I've never seen it before, never seen it again. It was called Johnny Three Legs Malt Liquor.
Johnny Three Legs,
and it had like a rooster on it, and he had three legs.
Interesting. Yeah, I don't know about that one. I know about some West Coast malt liquors that a buddy of mine would send after he first moved to California back in the late 90s. Laser malt liquor, I always thought was rather amusing. Howling Monkey malt liquor.
I remember going down to Atlanta and seeing my first 64 ounce 40. So
jeez, in Florida, quarts 32 ounce. I mean, they were the thing about Florida's alcohol laws were that you could only bottle beer in certain measurements, so it had to be 16 12 16 or 32, and if your beverage came in a different fluid measure, you couldn't get into Florida back in those days. I don't know if that's changed, but in the 90s when I was growing up, it was 12, 16, or 32. So we didn't have 40s down there.
I remember
it was always quarts.
Like going on a road trip with the fam, and I had to like be like, hey, we got to pull over or else I'm going to start getting the shakes pretty bad here, you know? And so we are in Pennsylvania. we pull over to a gas station. I'm like, that's weird. There's no beer here. Go to the supermarket. No beer at the supermarket. I'm like, what is going on? Like, turns out that, you know, Pennsylvania has really weird liquor laws, and you can't, you know, up until very recently, you know, you would have to buy your beer only in the back of bars. There'd be a bar, and there'd be a back entrance, and they sold beer out, but you couldn't just buy a six-pack or something. You would have to buy, like, a pony keg. Like, it was, like, the weirdest beer laws. And, like, if I'm correct, what they changed it to, and it was, like, a big triumph. It was like, we can buy a case of beer now. Like, but you still had to go to, like, the bar, to this screen door on the backside of some house bar. It was out in Amish country.
Yeah, the strange alcohol laws. Things have changed very much over the last couple decades.
For the better or the worse?
If you're a beer drinker, definitely for the better. If you don't enjoy it, yeah, you could come out against it, but I'm just neutral on the matter now.
I'm just saying that, like, I think we've reached saturation point for breweries.
Yeah, I can kind of go along with that. It's losing its novelty.
We don't need any more. Yeah. We got so many, you can't get a decent slushy anywhere in town. How about somebody open up a slushy, a non-alcoholic, just a slushy?
Yeah, just a good slushy.
Give me some slushies and hot dogs.
Oh, my word.
Meat and potatoes kind of guy. I'm a simple man.
Let's see. What's coming up? We're going to wind this hour down next segment. I got our fingers on some weirdness. Dark 30s coming up. We'll make a wrap of this and keep the craziness going when we come back. It's Speaking of Strange.
Arms around me, I need to feel your touch. Fickle flame. Hey! To think I held you yesterday, your love was just a game. A golden bird that flies away, a candle.
It's Speaking of Strange, all over the board tonight. We're just all over the place. Sam,
yes.
You're like our astronomy correspondent. Now, Sam brings up some what I think is significant news. Could go a little deep, but we'll just play it light. I mean, I recognize what a big deal potentially this is. Josh had worked on the Arecibo project in recent years, and he was very, you know, taken with the idea of the wow signal. Some listeners know what that's all about. I won't even try to explain because I don't have any real concept. Can't wrap my brain around some of these concepts. But here's basically, I think the headline is enough to get us interested. Repeating radio signals coming from distant galaxy detected by astronomers. And this is not just like an offhand sort of ufologist page. This is in Newsweek, published August 30th. That's just this week in Newsweek. Repeating radio signals from a mysterious source in a dwarf galaxy 3 billion light years away have been detected by astronomers. Using the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia, scientists with the Breakthrough Listen Initiative, a massive project dedicated to finding signs of intelligent alien life, recorded 15 repeating fast radio bursts, known as FRBs.
Furbs.
Furbies. On August 26th, the discovery was announced as an astronomer's telegram and will be described in further detail in a forthcoming scientific article, according to a statement from Breakthrough Listen. FRBs last just a few milliseconds and appear to be coming from deep space because FRBs have an extremely short duration and because scientists usually find them in data only after the event has taken place. Pinpointing their origin has not been possible. Fast radio bursts, but 15...
But I mean,
repeating
I think
bursts.
What's interesting about that is if it says like how many there had been in the previous like decade, and then there was that many at once. There had only been like 10 or 12 or something like in the last 10 years, and then they had like 12 in a day. And you have to wonder if whoever is got their ear hole peeled out on that one. Like, because it lasts a couple million. They said, like, the professor who found it, he's got something like 5 petaflops of data saved. And he's, like, just presumably going through and listening to, like, hiss, just. Ah! Don't you hear it? Did you hear it? Ah! And, like, getting all excited. And everybody's like, yeah, it was some static. He's like, it was a Furby! Ferb, it was a Ferb. We got a Ferb. Pancakes.
Phineas and Ferb. Yeah. A repeating pattern. I mean, that's the thing. One explanation has been that it could be a collapsing, a star collapsing into a black hole, but such an event would produce only one burst.
Not
doesn't
12.
Explain a repetitive pattern.
And they said that, you know, like while we can't rule anything out totally, it's probably not. You know, little green spacemen trying to get a message across or, you know, anything like that. But still, it's like how many billion light years away?
Good.
It's like three billion.
3 billion yeah. Light years away.
And that's quite a ways for something to travel. And while I was looking at that article, I don't know if you are looking at the same one that I saw. Does it have a picture from the Hubble Space Telescope of, like, the galaxies?
Yeah.
Beautiful is that?
That's pretty amazing. It looks like the facets of a gemstone sparkling.
Yeah, I mean, it's like
amazing.
All these little dots of color, and each one of those dots is bigger than our entire universe, like, or galaxy, you know? And you're like, how does that picture even get back? How did we get a telescope up there? How do we get that picture back? I don't even understand. I can't wrap my head around a lot of that stuff.
That's where I'm at, but it is beautiful, and it makes you feel
insignificant.
Well,
I wish more people would think that way instead of thinking they were the center of that universe you're looking at, because I think everybody thinks that since they have an Instagram, that they're like, look at my life. It's so special. I had French toast today. You're nothing. You're a speck of nothing.
That's our message here on Speaking of Strange Tonight. You are a speck of nothing.
But we love you.
But we love you anyway, you speck of nothing. Yeah, keep an ear out for Ferbs. Maybe it's just some of these little green men dropping some dank loops.
Dank out there loops.
In space. We'll be right back with the Dark 30. If you're into that sort of thing, stay tuned.